content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the April 12th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. And the cover drawing this week shows one of those famous double-decker British buses. It's red. It's got a British flag on the front, and it is going off the White Cliffs of Dover. There are a lot of characters on the bus, and I certainly don't recognize all of them. Theresa May is driving the bus with a panicked look on her face. I don't know the political faces, but on the top level, there's Queen Elizabeth and Prince Harry. It looks like Adele and Harry Potter and the Bear Paddington. The headline says, "Crash Landing, the UK's inability to wake from its Brexit nightmare." And we'll pick up one of the columns on that, but we'll start with a main story titled, "Trump's Threat to Close the Southern Border." What happened? Frustrated by a growing surge of Central American migrants applying for asylum, President Trump this week threatened to close the border with Mexico and ordered the State Department to slash $500 million in humanitarian aid to three Central American nations. About 76,000 migrants were intercepted or surrendered to authorities along the border in February, a 31% increase from January. Border apprehensions were on pace to exceed 100,000 in March, the highest level in a decade. With the holding pens running at 400% capacity, immigration officials fenced in hundreds of migrants under an El Paso highway bridge. Later, more than 2,000 migrants were simply released into Texas border towns. U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAlanan said the influx has stretched the agency's resources to the breaking point. Trump initially vowed to close 100% of the border if Mexico didn't take fast action to stop the flow of migrants across its territory. Administration officials, however, said trucks might be allowed to cross the border after alarmed business leaders and congressional Republicans said a complete closing would have a painful economic impact. Nearly $1.7 billion in goods and services cross the border every day. Trump said he won't rule out closing the border if the crossings continue. Sure, it's going to have a negative impact on the economy, Trump said, but security is most important. What the editorial said: even the most partisan Democrats are hard-pressed at this point to deny that the border crisis President Trump has long been warning about actually exists, said the New York Post. Our immigration laws, which allow virtually anyone to claim asylum once they've reached U.S. soil, desperately need updating. But instead of closing these loopholes, Democrats reflexively denounce anything the president does to get control of our border, forcing him to seek increasingly drastic solutions. They should help Trump solve this crisis or get out of the way. Trump's so-called solutions are both self-destructive and self-defeating, said the Baltimore Sun. Closing the border with our third largest trading partner would seriously damage our economy, disrupting supply chains and raising consumer prices. The U.S. imports nearly half of its produce from Mexico. By one estimate, avocados would run out within 3 weeks of the border closing. Cutting off humanitarian aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras is equally idiotic. It defies common sense to expect that making desperate countries more desperate will somehow stem the flow of refugees. What the columnist said: Mexico is already cooperating extensively with the U.S. on migration, said Dana Lind in Vox.com. Mexican authorities detain thousands of migrants and participate in the Trump administration's practice of metering the number of asylum seekers at ports of entry allowed to present their case each day. But threatening to cripple the Mexican economy and cutting off aid to Central America is a good way to end the partnership. Diplomacy requires more than just bullying. It wasn't Trump who broke our immigration system, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Laws and court rulings make it impossible to quickly return minors from Central American countries. And they and the adults accompanying them realize that we are helpless to exclude them. So they surrender to border agents and hope to be released into the U.S. pending hearings on their asylum claims. In a sane world, Congress would see the sad spectacle of immigration officials scrambling to handle a flood of humanity showing up every day and change the laws and provide more resources so that this influx could be brought under control. The Democrats' refusal to do so is a dereliction of duty of the highest order. The only effective and moral way to slow the exodus from Central America, said Will Bunch in Philly.com, is to address the abject poverty, lawlessness, and drug gang violence there. Migrants think they and their children will die if they don't walk over 1,000 miles to the U.S. border, so they'll take any risk to keep coming. But Trump's brand is crisis. And he'd rather that this one continue so his base can see images of thousands of brown-skinned foreigners trying to enter the country. As heartbreaking as those images are, the American president is hell-bent on making things worse. Controversy of the week is titled, Biden, Too Handsy to be President? Before last week, all the polls said former Vice President Joe Biden was the Democrat with the best chance of beating President Trump in 2020, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. But now it's very likely that Joe Biden is done. Last week, Lucy Flores, a former Democratic candidate in Nevada who supported Senator Bernie Sanders in 2016, published an essay recounting how the then vice president came up behind her at a 2014 campaign event, grabbed her shoulders, smelled her hair, and planted a big, slow kiss on her head. Biden's handsy behavior with women is the stuff of Washington legend, with plenty of photographic evidence. But in the Me Too era, Flores' first-person account of what it's like to have Creepy Joe sneak up behind you surely dooms his presidential hopes. After three other women told similar stories, Biden responded with a carefully worded damage control statement, said Sidney Imber in the New York Times. He admitted to touching over his political career, but said that he will now respect the reset social norms on personal boundaries. If Biden goes ahead with his planned run, the Democratic primary season will be dominated by an extended reckoning about Biden and gender. Joe Biden needs to cut it out, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. But so does the mob that is after him. Biden does indeed have a long history of putting his hands all over pretty much anyone who comes within reach. Men, women, children, friends, complete strangers. But this sudden insistence that his touchy-feely brand of politics disqualifies him from office is ridiculous. Women have every right to object to unwanted physical contact, but not every offense is of equal severity. White House counselor Kellyanne Conway had the gall to call Biden's behavior a big problem when her boss is on videotape bragging of grabbing women by the genitals. If Biden runs for president, the question will not be whether his hands are in the right place, but whether his heart is. Neither are in the right place, said Rebecca Traister in NYMag.com. The same old-fashioned paternalism that makes Biden think every woman's body is his to smell and squeeze and kiss has also shaped his political views. His record defending abortion rights is decidedly mixed, and no woman who watched the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings will ever forget Biden's horrifying failure as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee to protect Anita Hill from grotesque Republican abuse. Even if Biden was more obvious than predatory in his handsiness, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, why should Democrats choose a nominee who has to keep apologizing both for his handsiness and his backward policy history? Biden is a product of his time, but that time is up. Maybe it's just a coincidence, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com, but the progressives calling for Biden to step aside are the same people who think the Democrats should nominate a woman, a person of color, or the far-left Bernie Sanders. Their real objection is to Biden's centrism and lack of woke credentials. But the woke elite may have launched their transparent attack too soon, said Warren Henry in TheFederalist.com. In the incredible shrinking news cycle that governs modern politics, the allegations against Biden will quickly fade, especially if he refuses to be cowed. Riding out the storm often works. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for studying geography. After a Fox and Friends Chiron stated that President Trump had vowed to cut U.S. aid to three Mexican countries. Experts insist there is only one Mexican country in Latin America, Mexico. It was a good week for Shrill X, the electronic music pioneer whose signature blend of very high and low frequencies can stop mosquitoes from biting, according to new research. Scientists found that mosquitoes were so entertained by Shrill X dubstep that the occurrence of blood-feeding activity was lower. And it was a good week for Alaska, which had its warmest March in decades. Anchorage had 18 consecutive days above 40 degrees, and northern parts of the state reached 70 degrees, more than 40 degrees above normal. But it was also a bad week for Alaska. After warm temperatures began thawing, an estimated 66 tons of frozen human feces left by mountaineers on Denali, North America's highest mountain. We expect it to still smell bad and look bad, said a spokesman for the National Park Service. It was a bad week for nativism after the Associated Press reported that Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke gave a speech in his native Spanish in El Paso, Texas. O'Rourke, whose first and middle names are actually Robert Francis, is of Irish descent. And finally, it was a bad week for roots. After President Trump falsely stated that his father was born in a very wonderful place in Germany, Fred Trump was born in the Bronx, New York. In 1987's The Art of the Deal, Trump claimed that his father immigrated from Sweden as a child. On the briefing page this week, the enduring legend of Bigfoot. 60 years ago, a California logger found a set of enormous footprints. and a star was born. How did Bigfoot get its name? On August 27, 1958, a bulldozer operator for a Northern California logging company made a discovery. Jerry Crew was clearing away brush and stumps near Bluff Creek, about 300 miles north of San Francisco, when he found enormous man-like footprints in the mud. Shocked, he relayed the news and discovered his colleagues had also spotted mammoth tracks several times. News of their sightings was published in the local Humboldt Times. Giant footprints puzzle residents along Trinity River, read the October 5, 1958 story, which contained the first recorded use of the name Bigfoot. The Sunday story went out over the news wires, and on Monday, Tuesday, and for the rest of many days, Humboldt Times columnist Andrew Genzoli said, "We had reporters from all the wire services pounding on our doors." Was the story true? No. After Crew's co-worker Ray Wallace died at 84 in 2002, his children revealed a secret Wallace had concealed for decades. He'd made the prints by stomping in the mud with carved wooden feet. It was all just a joke, they said. News of Wallace's hoax, however, barely registered with Bigfoot believers. Today, interest in the existence of the creature is at an all-time high, said paleontologist Darren Naish. In May, thousands of believers will attend one of the largest ever Bigfoot conferences in Ohio, where, organizers say, speakers from across the Bigfoot community share their experiences and knowledge in the subject of Sasquatch. Is Bigfoot a purely American phenomenon? Sightings of a similar half-man, half-ape have been reported by people all over the world. Indigenous tribes of British Columbia called the creature Sesquatch, meaning wild man, and the term was later anglicized to Sasquatch. The Chinese believe a Yeren roams the western Hubei Mountains. Australians say a Yowie stalks the outback. When Alexander the Great conquered the Indus Valley in 326 BC, he demanded the vanquished population bring him a Himalayan Yeti. By any name, this mythical creature is usually described as a bipedal hominid sporting a shaggy coat of hair covering its 8 to 12 foot tall frame, although sightings of juveniles also occur. The brute can weigh 800 pounds and leave footprints twice the size of a normal human adult's. Bigfoot believers contend the creature is the proverbial missing link between man and his evolutionary forebears. Had there been other hoaxes? Bigfoot's legend seems fertile terrain for rogues and raconteurs. In 1957, a prospector named Albert Ostman came forward with a tale of having been abducted in 1924 by a Sasquatch and forced to live with its family for 6 days until he escaped. In 2008, two Georgia men, one a former policeman, claimed to have recovered a Bigfoot corpse in their native mountains. But after an international media frenzy, it was discovered they had purchased a Bigfoot costume and stuffed it with roadkill and animal entrails. But the most famous suspected hoax came just 9 years after Wallace's 1958 prank. In 1967, Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin made a 59-second film showing an ape-like creature walking around near the same Bluff Creek of the original sighting. Years later, costume manufacturer Philip Morris said he sold Patterson the gorilla suit seen in the film and introduced a large man who said he tromped around in the costume for the camera. How frequent are sightings? In America, the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, BFRO, lists more than 5,000 sightings from every state except Hawaii, with about one-third coming from the Pacific Northwest. In January, hikers in Provo, Utah, spotted a massive dark figure moving slowly along a mountainside. "Seriously, look how big it is," cries hiker Austin Craig on a video posted on YouTube. Real or not, the country's love affair with the monster is indisputable. The last 2 years brought two children's films, The Son of Bigfoot and Smallfoot. Animal Planet just concluded an 11-season running of Finding Bigfoot, which never quite lived up to its name. What do scientists think? Scientifically speaking, there is not a single iota of evidence showing that Bigfoot is real. Nothing. Nothing at all, said Mark Wilson, a natural sciences professor who has studied the sightings. No bodies, no bones, no hair, no skin, no DNA. A 2009 study proposed a theory about what eyewitnesses are seeing. Researchers plotted Bigfoot sightings and found they corresponded roughly to the American black bear's habitat. Black bears can look frighteningly tall and human-like, the authors noted, when standing upright on two legs. Other scientists point out the unlikelihood that a species populous enough to breed could evade all attempts to find it. It defies all logic, said anthropologist Philip Stevens, Jr. Nevertheless, the legend persists. Famed anthropologist Jane Goodall has heard indigenous people on several continents describe sightings of Bigfoot-like creatures. Well, you will be amazed when I tell you that I'm sure that they exist, Goodall said. I guess I'm romantic. I don't want to disbelieve. Why people want Bigfoot to be real? Nature writer Robert Michael Pyle studied Bigfoot enthusiasts and concluded their obsession gives them a good excuse to spend time in remote wooded areas. These guys don't want to find Bigfoot. They want to be Bigfoot, he wrote. Others frame Bigfoot as a symbol of freedom from the modern world, a simple creature who is free of civilization's rules and boundaries. It's comforting to believe another hominid evolved without the cruelty, greed, vanity, and other childishness of Homo sapiens, says naturalist David Raines Wallace, who has studied Bigfoot lore. Folklore professor Lynn McNeil says Bigfoot satisfies a deep human hunger for the mysterious and the magical, and serves as proof that humans have not totally dominated nature. It's a better world if Bigfoot can be real, McNeil says. It says something positive about our retention of wilderness spaces. It says something positive about the fact that maybe we aren't utterly destroying the planet we live on if a species can remain hidden and undiscovered. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with one from the U.S. Frank Bowman from Slate.com writes, "Why Mueller couldn't be a savior." The left is now brokenhearted, but Robert Mueller was never going to solve our national political crisis, said Frank Bowman. Despite how liberals idealized the special counsel as a superhero, it was highly unlikely that Mueller could find such damning proof of conspiracy between Trump and the Russians that even Republicans would impeach him. Yes, the Russians hacked Democratic emails and gave some Trump associates advance word they would be released. Yes, the Russians mounted a large-scale social media effort to boost Trump and damage Hillary Clinton. Trump welcomed the help. But did Vladimir Putin's operatives ask Trump's amateurish campaign team if they should do any of this or involve them in the process, necessary components of a criminal conspiracy? The Russians are far too shrewd for that. Hardly the deep state partisan warrior Trump made him out to be, Mueller conducted his investigation narrowly and by the book. He didn't think it was his job to solve the problems that Trump's assaults on decency and constitutional norms have created for our democracy. Instead, Mueller has paid the American system of government and his fellow citizens the great compliment of trusting us to solve it for ourselves. This from the United Kingdom, referencing back to the cover drawing. May's disastrous failure to lead. This was supposed to be the week that British lawmakers finally broke the Brexit deadlock, said Kate Devlin in the Times. Yet after a succession of votes and acrimonious scenes, Parliament still can't decide how or even whether the UK should lead the European Union. The divorce deal that Prime Minister Theresa May negotiated with the bloc is effectively dead, having been voted down three times in a row. Hardline Brexiteers in her own party have refused to support the plan because it would keep Britain bound by EU tariffs and regulations indefinitely, while a way is worked out to avoid a hard border and checkpoints going up between Ireland, an EU member, and the UK province of Northern Ireland. With May unable to persuade the hardliners, lawmakers broke with parliamentary tradition this week and wrested power from the Prime Minister, so non-binding votes could be held on alternate Brexit plans. The four options were a new referendum, the scrapping of Brexit altogether, and two plans for a so-called softer Brexit. No option won a majority, and now May must ask the EU for a long delay or Britain will crash out of the bloc with no deal on April 12th. This comedy of errors has the perfect accompaniment, said Henry Deeds in Daily Mail, a parade of wiggling bottoms. As lawmakers debated, 10 climate change protesters in the gallery dropped their pants and then thrusted, gyrated, and boogie-woogied their half-naked bodies in front of the chamber. Police showed up and chased them about, and since the gallery glass is soundproof, it was like watching a saucy Benny Hill sketch without the daft music. Spurned by her conservatives, May is now trying to woo the opposition Labour Party, said The Guardian in an editorial. She invited Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn for emergency talks this week, saying she hoped to find a common Brexit position. Perhaps a softer exit that could draw enough Labour and Conservative votes to pass. Her failure to lead has left her government a laughingstock, so now she is turning to the opposition party to save her. The suspicion is that May does not want to share the glory, just the blame. Nobody wants Britain to lead the EU with no deal, said Peter Foster in the Daily Telegraph. New customs checks could cause trucks carrying food, medicine, and other essentials from the continent to the UK to stack up on the French side of the English Channel. Germany and other major exporters fear that their economies will take a big hit in the chaos. That means we must now beg the EU for a possibly months-long Brexit extension. It is not assured. The UK would have to agree to hold elections for the European Parliament in May and convince all 27 other EU member states that it will make good use of its extra time. French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that the EU will not be hostage to the UK. A no-deal Brexit may be upon us. And this from Mexico. Can it stop the wave of migrants heading north? Donald Trump has reverted to his incendiary and provocative rhetoric against Mexico, said Federico Borrito in Milenio. The U.S. president warned last week that if Mexican government didn't stop Central American migrants from crossing into the U.S., he would shut all 330 ports of entry along our two nations' 2,000-mile border. His administration also said it would terminate some $700 million in aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, the three countries that have sent the most migrants north. The threats are preposterous. Cutting aid to Central America will further hurt these already impoverished, crime-ravaged countries and increase the exodus of desperate people. Closing the U.S. border will damage both our economies. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has refused to address Trump's threats directly, merely saying that he will act with great prudence. That's the right call. Trump won the White House in 2016 in part by demonizing Mexico, and he hopes that the same strategy will guarantee him re-election in 2020. It's ugly, but the demagoguery over there should not be answered with demagoguery here. In the short term, Mexican officials must ignore Trump, said Jorge Fernandez Menendez in El Debate. They can work more productively with members of the U.S. Congress who represent border states, which have much to lose from a closure. But in the long term, we need to step up the policing of our southern border. Most of the migrants fleeing Central America are simply seeking a better life in the north. But in their midst are gang members and drug traffickers. For the safety of our own citizens, we can't leave the southern border open to massive entry. López Obrador has helped fuel this unprecedented humanitarian crisis, said El Diario de Juarez in an editorial. Fearing negative headlines about the mistreatment of migrants, he ordered police to avoid physical coercion and let all Central Americans cross our southern border. Hundreds of thousands of people have now walked the length of Mexico in subhuman conditions to chase the American dream. Women, men, and children suffer from blistered feet and broken bones, thirst and hunger, cold and heat. Many fall prey to criminal gangs as they wait for months in Tijuana for the chance to present their asylum claims to U.S. officials. Where are the authorities in all this? Where is the United Nations? Mexico is failing these people. All Mexico can offer is banana diplomacy, said Cecilia Soto in Excelsior. The Mexican president met informally last month with Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, who has expertise in nothing but failed real estate deals. López Obrador said Kushner assured him that Trump would provide a $10 billion development fund to create new jobs and opportunities in Central America. But it's now clear that Kushner does not speak for Trump, who not only canceled the $10 billion plan, but also withdrew millions in committed aid. Next time, López Obrador should leave diplomacy to the experts in the foreign ministry. The Last Word article is titled, An Addiction That States Encourage. Lotteries depend on the poor and gambling addicts for most of their revenues, said journalist Bryce Covert in Topic.com. But 44 states still actively promote them as the fastest way to realize the American dream. Adam Osmond lived and lost the American dream by gambling on lottery tickets that often promise to take players from rags to riches. In 1984, at the age of 17, Osmond came to the United States from Somalia to attend Central Connecticut State University, a college in New Britain, Connecticut. While in school, he worked at a local convenience store part-time, eventually moving up to store manager. Back then, scratch-off lottery tickets in the state typically cost a dollar, so Osmond would play them at work every so often for fun. I'm always into numbers, said Osmond, who liked playing tickets that let him select different combinations of digits. After graduating from college, Osmond became an accountant for the state government, but he also wanted to pursue being a business owner on the side. He bought his first convenience store in 1998, the same year his first daughter was born, and later acquired a gas station with a store, both located near his alma mater in the snowy, quiet New England town. Osmond is clearly a businessman. He comes to our meeting at Dunkin' Donuts, not far from his former stores, dressed in a blue and white striped collared shirt with French cuffs, gray slacks, and brown dress shoes, holding a legal pad in a leather case. His dark hair, showing some signs of graying, is close-cropped, and the walnut skin of his face is cleanly shaven. It was when he owned his businesses that his lottery playing changed and eventually became a problem. By the late 1990s, when he had already bought his first store, the price of tickets was going up. Scratch-offs could go for $10 or even $30, with the lure of bigger winnings. After he bought the second store in 2002, Osman started playing more, purchasing tickets at his own stores. "The more I play, the more I wondered, what if I win?" he recalls. In 2004, Osman won $3,800, which was then his highest jackpot ever. "After that, it got really bad," he says. He began playing almost daily. He switched to different kinds of tickets, called Play 3 and Play 4, which let a player pick a set of numbers. The drawings were twice a day instead of daily or weekly, giving him instant gratification. The immediacy with which the games concluded and the big payouts that could follow only made things worse. "The worst thing that happens to any gambler is when you hit something big," Osman explains. "Whatever I win, I would play more." In 2007, Osman won two $25,000 payouts. He had plowed those winnings back into new tickets within a week. Soon he started pouring all of his money, his entire income, plus any money he won playing the lottery, into lottery tickets. "Every penny that I won and every penny that I earned was going to it," he says. Eventually, he was gambling over $20,000 a week, playing nonstop. It wasn't about the fun of playing numbers like his daughter's birthday or his anniversary date. "It's not even about the money," he said. "It's about being in the action. It makes you high." Losing made Osman want to play more to achieve the next win. Each time he won, his mind would tell him, "You could win more. Why stop now?" And of course, his businesses gave him instant access to more tickets. "It's like an alcoholic owning a bar," Osman said. "I owned my own little casino." Today, all but six states, Alabama, Alaska, Hawaii, Mississippi, Nevada, and Utah, run a lottery. Once they realized lotteries could be a source of revenue, growth exploded during the economic upheaval of the 1980s. A 2017 University of Massachusetts study found that nearly two-thirds of Massachusetts adults play the lottery in a typical year. But for people with gambling addictions, the numbers are much higher. About 95% of problem gamblers play it. Overall, between 83,152 and 135,122 adult residents are problem gamblers, and between 389,776 and 488,519 adult residents are at-risk gamblers. These frequent, sometimes compulsive players are where the real state money lies. The casual player that might jump in when the Powerball is big, they're irrelevant to the revenue model, said Les Bernal, national director of the nonprofit Stop Predatory Gambling, adding that state lotteries make their money on the highly repetitive games. Such core players are only about 10 to 15% of all people who play the lottery, but account for 80% of sales. "A lot of my customers had the same problems," Osman said. "A small percentage of people were responsible for all the sales. That group," he explains, "would come in every morning, buy tickets, then return to buy more at lunch, and I was the biggest one." By 2005, Osman knew he had a problem, but he kept his addiction a secret from his wife and children. "No one knew anything about it," he says. "The only people aware of this issue were officials at the Connecticut Lottery, who met with him in February 2008 after his store's high sales and payouts raised concerns. They asked if he had a lottery addiction, but he told them no, not wanting to admit that there might be a problem. They let him continue running the lottery out of his stores. As long as I was paying them every week, they were very happy, he says. After all, Osmond's stores were the biggest source of lottery sales in his entire region. By the summer of 2008, he said his addiction affected everything in his life. At that point, Osmond's health had started to decline, and he wasn't eating well or taking care of his businesses. His store sales floundered. It wasn't until 6 months after the first meeting with the Connecticut Lottery that the state stepped in and cut off his machines. He had started printing tens of thousands of tickets without cashing any of the winning ones. I just wanted to get caught, and I wanted them to shut down the machine, he explains. State governments that rely on lotteries for revenue have a clear goal: increase the money they make off the cut they take from each game played. Achieving this goal often means getting more people to play or extracting larger sums of money from dedicated fans. An enormous amount of their profits comes from people who are addicted, Bernal says. The perverse incentive for states to maximize gambling profits is the opposite of what people expect from their government, which is tasked, at least in part, with protecting public health and discouraging addiction. Yet states are generally making problems worse, not better. Traditional lottery games involve long intervals between the time people place bets and when they discover whether or not they've won. When people fill out a Powerball or Mega Millions ticket, they have to wait a few days to realize any wins. But according to Bernal, though they often get the most press, with Mega Millions jackpots and the hundreds of millions making regular appearances in newspapers and on the nightly news, these kinds of games aren't the primary source of most lottery addictions. Instead, states have expanded into games that offer instant rewards. To get more money from scratch tickets, states like Texas have made individual ticket prices higher while increasing the rates of payout. Some tickets cost as much as $50 each. We call it juicing the ticket, Bernal says. This plays directly into the kinds of things that are associated with gambling addiction: speed of play, instant reward, and large jackpots. A higher payout sounds like a good deal until it becomes clear that the most frequent players, like Osmond, simply put winnings back into buying more scratch-offs. Gambling can act like a narcotic, explains Keith White, executive director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, which advocates for services to help people with gambling addictions. Many gambling addicts develop tolerance. You need to bet more and more money to achieve that same high. So they keep betting more and more money, including the proceeds from their wins, to get that rush. Others chase their losses, funneling wins into plays in an effort to make back all the money they've lost. I've had some lottery addicts in particular describe a big win as depressing or infuriating, White says. They only walk away when they don't have any more money to play. A big win just means they stay there longer. Now states are pushing into online and app-based games. These new games typically require legislative approval, but it's already happening in some places like Michigan, which offers online games on the state lottery website that are essentially virtual scratch-offs. This includes Wizard of All, which is designed to look like Harry Potter, and Gym Blaster, which looks like Candy Crush. Younger people aren't playing lottery games, which is why they're pushing to bring it online, Bernal explains. They put Las Vegas on Main Street. Now they're trying to bring Las Vegas into every home, every office, right into your living room. Lotteries are often established when the economy is suffering and state government casts about for sources of revenue. Officials usually sell the public on starting or expanding lotteries by saying the money will be earmarked for important public goods, most commonly education, but also other services like mass transit or environmental conservation. on top of the harm brought to families like Osmond's, these promises are a bad bill of goods. Across all states and localities, lotteries brought in just $17.7 billion in 2015, according to an analysis by Urban Brookings researcher Lucy Dadian. That may sound like a lot of money, but in 2017, state total revenues came to over $2.5 trillion. Lottery revenues also don't grow much over time. In 2008, they were $17.4 billion adjusted for inflation, meaning they grew less than $500 million over the span of nearly a decade. Revenues actually fell in 21 states. Even as the number of states with lotteries has steadily increased since 1979, the real growth rate in lottery revenues has fallen. Part of the reason lottery revenues don't increase is that states get a set amount from each game played, and the number of people playing doesn't tend to increase year after year. It's a fixed number of people and a fixed pot of money. At the end of the day, we know that revenues from lottery are not budget solvers, Dadian says. Meanwhile, reams of research have found that the poorest Americans spend the biggest shares of their incomes on the lottery, including the industry's own internal research. And research by the Business School of Carnegie Mellon has also found that most of these players aren't doing it for fun, but out of a desire to improve their finances. The higher the poverty rate, the higher the lottery sales, a relationship that doesn't exist for other forms of entertainment, such as movie tickets. Lotteries have come to represent, for millions of Americans, the best way to change their lives, Bernal says. This has come to represent the American dream. States spend next to nothing on actually helping addicts. Yet compulsive gambling comes with a cost, one that few states factor in when they think about their lotteries. There is, of course, the cost in lost money, or even loss of life for an addict and his family, but there are also societal costs. White's organization estimates that with the most severe gambling addictions, each cost a state $1,700 a year through the criminal justice and health care systems. Although he went into treatment and hasn't gambled for nearly 11 years, Adam Osmond eventually lost both his house and the two stores that fueled his addiction. But the stores still sell plenty of lottery tickets. Plastered to the windows of his former gas station are signs boasting of the sale of tickets that won their purchasers anywhere from $1,000 to $100,000. A Connecticut lottery sign showcasing a dancing figure with dollar bills raining down over its head is still screwed to the brick wall of the old convenience store. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Topic.com. We'll read one of the health and science articles. The dangers of edible marijuana. Pot-infused brownies, gummy bears, and other cannabis edibles are often portrayed as a fun and harmless way to ingest cannabis. But a new study suggests that eating weed may be more dangerous than smoking or vaping the drug. Researchers looked at thousands of marijuana-related emergency room visits in Denver from 2014, when the drug was legalized in Colorado, to 2016, reports the New York Times. While edibles represented only 0.3% of the total weight sold of THC, the psychoactive compound in weed, they accounted for 10% of the cannabis-linked ER admissions. Patients displayed markedly different symptoms depending on how they consumed the drugs. Nearly half of the patients who'd taken edibles complained of intoxication, compared with less than a third of those who'd smoked marijuana. Those who used edibles were also more likely to experience acute psychiatric symptoms and cardiovascular issues such as irregular heartbeat. The scientists say the most likely reason for the disparity is that ingested weed takes longer to produce a high than smoked cannabis does. So users think the drug isn't working and take more. Lead author Andrew Monte notes that the only three deaths in Colorado that have been definitely linked to marijuana, two suicides and a murder, all involved edibles. States moving to liberalize cannabis policy, he says, should consider keeping edibles out of the recreational marketplace. And we'll go right over to the talking points page, starting with Mayor Pete, Democrats' new dark horse. Pete Buttigieg, Edge, is having a moment, said Nathaniel Rekich in 538.com. The 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is the first breakout contender in the Democratic presidential primary, placing third in a recent poll of Iowa voters and raising an impressive $7 million. Most Americans haven't heard of Mayor Pete, who's still explaining how to pronounce his Maltese name, Buttigieg. Yet he wins supporters with every TV appearance, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. In an absurdly crowded primary, his profile is unlike any other presidential candidate ever. He's a married gay man, a devout Episcopalian, a Harvard graduate, a Rhodes Scholar, and a Navy veteran who took a six-month leave of absence as mayor to serve in Afghanistan. Though left of center, he's primarily an earnest pragmatist who claims he's uniquely qualified to bridge the divide between America's coasts and its flyover states. We would be well served if Washington started to look more like our best-run cities and towns, Buttigieg says. Despite the modest exterior, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com, Buttigieg is wildly ambitious, even by politician standards. Not many gay small city mayors under 40 run for president. He's also bright, level-headed, and more liberal than he lets on, supporting a form of Medicare for All and so-called Green New Deal. On paper, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com, it's easy to compare Buttigieg to another young presidential hopeful, Beto O'Rourke. But the former congressman from El Paso is an attention-seeking trust fund baby experiencing a public midlife crisis. If liberals want a dark horse with authentic charisma, intellect, and policy chops, Buttigieg over Beto is a no-brainer. Amid this Buttigieg boomlet, it's easy to forget that not long ago, his sexuality probably would have been a deal-breaker, said David Byler in WashingtonPost.com. But the public's views on LGBT issues have shifted astonishingly quickly. In a 2015 poll, 74% of Americans said they would vote for a well-qualified gay presidential candidate. Of course, people who say they'll vote for a gay candidate might still find an excuse to shy away. But even if Buttigieg doesn't end up in the White House, a campaign in which his sexual orientation is a non-issue is a real, if subtle, victory for the LGBT equality. Healthcare. Does the GOP have a plan? Republicans have a spectacular plan to provide better, cheaper health care for everyone, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. What is it? You'll just have to wait at least 2 years to find out. President Trump renewed his administration's chaotic assault on the Affordable Care Act last week by asking the courts to throw out the law in its entirety while swearing Republicans are working on something really spectacular to replace it. Congressional Republicans, however, were aghast over Trump's decision to revisit the health care issue, since their doomed 2017 repeal crusade helped cost them 40 House seats in the midterm elections. When Republican leaders this week begged Trump not to revisit health care now, Trump announced he'd unveil his spectacular plan after the 2020 election. The White House has already given us a strong hint of what it will do, said Sarah Cliff in Vox.com. Despite Trump's promise to cover everybody for less money, Republicans have consistently pursued an agenda that does the opposite. All of the various options the GOP would put on the table in recent years would have taken away health insurance from millions of people while providing weaker protections for patients with pre-existing conditions. Last month, Trump's proposed budget called for reviving a version of the GOP's unpopular 2017 Graham-Cassidy health care bill. That defeated proposal would have cut $230 billion in health care spending over 10 years, while forcing millions to lose coverage. It would also have allowed states to give insurers permission to charge patients with pre-existing conditions much higher premiums. Instead of touting unpopular policies, the Trump administration has simply decided not to tell the truth about them. The truth, said Betsy McCauley in New York Post, is that conservatives do have policy ideas that would make health insurance better and cheaper. Premiums for healthy people are unfairly expensive under Obamacare because 5% of the population accounts for nearly 50% of health care costs. If the government separated chronically ill into a high-risk pool, it could provide a $20 billion subsidy to keep their premiums affordable while lowering everyone else's. Republicans do need a plan they can confidently sell to the public, said the National Review in an editorial. In 2018, Democrats convinced voters that Republicans wanted to repeal Obamacare with nothing to replace it. In 2020, hiding from the issue will backfire on the GOP again. Replacing Obamacare is still a Republican duty. And we will finish up with a quote from Hall of Famer baseball player Ted Williams. This was quoted in the Japan Times. He says, "Baseball is the only field of endeavor where a man can succeed 3 times out of 10 and be considered a good performer." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.